Hi, this is Vicky. Just before we get started, a quick word about content warnings. Many of these podcast episodes contain discussions on gender identity, sexual orientation, medical procedures, surgery, mental health issues, self-harm, suicide, and suicidal ideation. Please seek appropriate help if you are affected in any way when listening to these discussions. Thank you. Hello, Steph, and hello, Violet. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Vicky. Hi, Violet.
Hey there. I'm well as well, thank you.
So this is our second podcast in the FGEN series of podcasts. Today, Violet and I will be interviewing Steph from Steph's Place. So welcome, Steph.
Thank you so much.
Could you just explain to us what Steph's Place is all about and how that was formed? And then we'll just talk about, you know, how it's related to FGEN.
Yeah, sure. So I founded Steph's Place some 18 months ago, principally because I could see the UK becoming more transphobic, that trans people were having a hard time of it in regards to the media, with regards to politicians, how the gender identity was under threat. What particularly annoyed me was how gender criticals were constantly coming up with this term, gender ideology, which none of us know what it means. But it's obviously the politicalization of a group of people. And that really, really annoyed me. We're not an idea, we're not an ideology, we're biology, we're people. Within a diverse world, and to single us out through the media in particular, give us bad press. I mean, the only time, for example, the Times give good press is for trans people that's prepped in other countries. They don't want to know about America and the UK. We just get bad press. And that really, really annoyed me. And I was in stealth up to that point. I'm lucky that I pass. I've got a reasonably femme voice. And I just felt like coming out, to be honest with you. So I came out of stealth, launched Steph's Place. I had to learn how to, because I'm getting on a bit. I've never done social media before. So I got a mentor that helped me with social media, Aaron Bastini from Navarra. Very kindly taught me how to use Twitter, bless him, and launched the website, went on Twitter, gained followers, started doing investigative articles, blogs, and then last year I brought in four co-editors. Just through Twitter you could find such amazing, talented people, and I think this is one of the advantages of being trans. We are a pretty bright bunch at the end of the day. There's some really incredible people within the trans community. And I could see that, like, from what Claire Prasciaro does, she's just an incredible mind. So she became co-edit Steph's Place. And then there was Paul, who just knows everything about sport and trans sport.
Yeah.
Then we've got Julie Miller, and Julie Besser is out in the community. She works with various organizations, and including training in the health professionals. So she goes into universities and things like that. And then a few months after, Nicola joined us as well, and then she did like all the blog posts with Helen Webberly's Tribunal. Bless her, she was working through to 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I remember reading those. It was really kind of on point, very accurate.
Absolutely.
You did an amazing job.
Yeah, and she's got a history as well, that sort of thing. So it's not for me to say what Nicola's done. She's, you know, it's just a phenomenal team that we've got. And we're knocking out investigative articles all the time. We're doing freedom of information requests. Some information we publish ourselves. Other information we give to journalists. We send dossiers to MPs. We do a fair old bit one way or another. I'm delighted. And our figures just throughout this world, we get amazing. A number of people come to the website. We've increased another 20% in the last 2 months.
Yeah, so just remind us, what is the website address?
It's Stephsplace UK. So it's www.stephsplace.uk. And we're just out there to help trans people, really. And
you do have a whole kind of catalogue of articles that have been written by various people in your website.
Yep, and we've even got one or two from Gender Criticals.
Oh, really? I haven't seen those.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't recommend them. No. No, I'm unfair. We try to be fair to Gender Criticals and feminists. It's a hard one to call because ultimately it upsets trans people, and I understand that. But if I write an article, I've kind of got a bit of an obligation to talk to Gender Criticals. And then, of course, we've got the issue as well of kids on Twitter in particular setting up accounts and playing one side off against the other. And I think there's also another element that we don't take into account, and that's actually interference from other countries. You know, the gender wars, it causes disturbance within feminism. And I'm a rad femme. And I've been a huge feminist all my life. What the gender war does is it takes the emphasis out of us holding men to account. We are in a patriarchal society, and I think ultimately all the time feminists are scrapping with each other. Men get away free. I should be out writing political articles about Boris Johnson. I should be out there writing articles about the pay gap for women. I should be out there writing articles in regards to universal cuts, in regards to allowances and things like that, and care. The actual social care budget keeps on falling and falling. And these are the sorts of things that need to be called out, which, you know, I'm Labour, I'm to the left. I used to be to the right. If you go back historically, I was actually a member of the Conservative Party. I mean, I left at the time when they brought out Sunday trading. So I left the Tories at that point and then kind of drifted into the middle. And probably about 6-7 years ago, I started to think how rotten society was and how we needed to go more to the left and to look after people and not money. I think we should be starting to put people first. So I'm now a staunch Labour supporter, a member of the Labour Party. I'm a member of Labour Trans Equality. I'm a member of the Labour Women's Network. I'm a member of the Fawcett Society. And I will do anything possible to help people.
I was really interested what you were talking a little while ago about identifying as radical feminists. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about how inside radical feminism these conversations can be had, because I think, as you were alluding to, in my experience as well, whenever I try to have conversations about especially trans inclusive feminism, but also, for example, sex worker inclusive feminism or just intersectional feminism in a more broad topic, that it is almost always infighting that sort of dominates. And I completely agree. Like, if we take sex work, for example, with radical feminists, I've had quite a lot of discussions and it gets quite personal between liberal feminists and radical feminists on this topic. And the elephant in the room to me is that the men that are actually benefiting primarily from the whole system aren't even in the conversation at all. And we're sort of hurting each other, getting very upset on Twitter, for example. And the people that are actually responsible for the system aren't in this conversation at all, and aren't feeling that pain.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think sex work's a real problem. One side of me sees that a woman most definitely should not be exploited. You know, that's kind of core. And then on the other side of me, I think, yeah, but prostitution's been going on for God knows many thousands of years, and you're not going to stop it.
Yeah.
That's the bottom, you know, that's a bottom line as well. And I'm quite radical on lots of things. I would legalize drugs tomorrow.
Mm.
You can't fight this. And yeah. I would also legalize prostitution because as much as it's against a woman's body, equally, as long as it's their body, and they're not being controlled by anyone else whatsoever, so there's no pimps, then it's a little bit like abortion. It's kind of their right to choose. Do I like it? No, I don't like it. You know, if any of my daughters turn around and say they want to be, you know, work in the sex industry, I would be pretty gutted. So I can understand with other people as well. And yeah, you're right, you know, rad femmes. I mean, my own city, you know, there's been an application for like a lap dance club. And do I approve of it? No, I don't. And, you know, there's within gender quits, there's obviously a lot of rad femme. I don't know how many, you know, I'm a TERF with an I. I'm a trans inclusionary radical feminist as a TERF with an E. Mm-hmm. But I share lots of their beliefs. You know, I looked at all the different elements of feminism, and I just identify as a rad fem.
Mm-hmm. And
it actually comes from my childhood, or not so much from my childhood, but from when I was a kind of a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Because my dad used to turn around to me and said, the problem is that politics and religion cause war. And I very quickly worked out before I was probably 20 that it was men's vision of politics and religion. Because who wrote the Bible? Men. Who edited the Bible? You can guarantee men. Who rules the world at the moment? Men. Who starts wars? Men. Who fight wars? Men. Who picks up the pieces? Women. And women are oppressed. Women don't deserve this. Women should have exactly the same rights as men. Mm. And whichever country you look at, if you look at in America, I think the Republicans, for example, and they've sort of all the Republican, I forget the name of it, like the chair group, just one below the top guy. But it's kind of 85% men. When we look at the cabinet in the UK, there's literally a handful of women. Even Margaret Thatcher, I think it took her years to bring a woman into her cabinet. This is all wrong.
I think that sort of thing's an interesting example as well of like, the patriarchal system being the issue rather than necessarily any individuals. So, for example, Margaret Thatcher is a woman. She's an individual woman. And I would say, in my opinion, that she positioned herself in such a way to cater to the patriarchy and the status quo. And she became useful to them within the capacity of herself as an individual. But she was not having any sort of solidarity to change patriarchy on a fundamental basis. And this is the way that a system like patriarchy works, a system of power works, is that it rewards those people that pay into the maintenance of the current power structure. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is women are rewarded for pulling up patriarchy, you know, maintaining it. That's where the reward inside that system comes from. And I think that's why the power distribution kind of maintains quite well, because, you know, you centralize the power and then you reward that power to people that keep the same people in control. I mean, of course, capitalism runs on the same basis, which is the powerful stay powerful. And basically what we mean, what that means is all power structures are going to benefit those that are in power because they can set the rules. I think it's a good example to remind ourselves that any individual woman that is empowered does not mean that women as a group are actually in a greater position than they were otherwise before that woman was empowered herself.
I think you're right. It's just stacked against women. And that was one of the great things, I think, when we changed the name of FGEN, that, you know, because it was obviously originally gender gin, wasn't it? I don't remember what the...
And Gender Inclusion Network.
That's right. Yeah, the Inclusion Network, which we kind of lost the inclusion, which was wonderful. And we brought in this feminist, and the gender critics didn't like it. But I'm sorry, we are feminists. And I'm proud feminist. Mm. And way before I was, you know, when I went into transition, I was a feminist. I've been a feminist for years, because I could just see how wrong it was for women and girls in this country. So when we changed, great.
I consider myself a feminist as an accurate way to describe my beliefs. And I just happen to be a trans woman. That's who I am. Like, that's it's not a active sort of point of view that I look at the world through. It's an experience, but it's not an ideology, as I so often accused. But being a feminist is an ideology, and it's the ideology that I, as a trans woman, and my sisters that are cis, and all of the women and girls in my life are equal and deserve the same rights and opportunities as the men and boys in my life. You know, and that's a very simple thing. And I need that. You know, I feel in my own life constant pressures to sort of being in different environments, especially male-dominated ones, and being sort of objectified. And I have the additional experience of having transphobia with that. So it's a kind of interesting mix for me. But the point is that feminist ideals are critical to being able to, you know, help me live my life. Like, if feminist movements hadn't changed things so that they are as they are now, and women had the vote, for example, and all these things, would I have any imagination that I would be able to have the acceptance as a trans woman in the first place that I have today? Of course not. These are foundational principles that have led the way to the rights that I have today. And it's no way to extricate those things. There's no way. And the basis on which we respect the gender of a transgender person, whether it's trans man, trans woman, or a non-binary person, those bases are the same as we respect any cisgender person, as far as their expression and how they live their lives. And so, you know, you have Tufts constantly talking about this thing of, like, you can be a feminine man, and you can be a masculine woman. Well, absolutely. And actually, the community, like the trans community and the feminist inclusive community, are the people that actually allow people to do that. Like, the reasons why, in my view, people don't more express more diverse gender outside of the trans community is because of the patriarchal judgment of how people are pigeonholed into how they have to be inside society. So we all need feminism to get past that.
Yeah, it's fundamental. Yeah, I think you've nailed that, Violet. I think that's spot on. And it's really interesting to know, you know, you've got like WP UK, and they have a crack about non-binary. Sorry, these are people. And if they want to be non-binary, they can damn well be non-binary. Mm. Nothing wrong. People are people. And whether they're trans, mac, or whatever, it really doesn't make a difference how they live their lives. The important thing is we don't go around hurting each other.
Mm.
And then we start seeing the gender critical camp attacking trans people. They turn around and say, we're attacking women's rights. We're not attacking women's rights at all. I totally disagree with that. You know, we have been going into single sex spaces on a case by case basis mm-hmm. for decades. Mm. Simple as that.
How else do they think the trans women and trans men were living? I mean, they would have noticed it far more if we were transitioned and then we went to the boys' loos or whatever, and vice versa if trans men were going into the women's loos. Like, there's no way. It's preposterous, you know.
It is, you know, and the just coming out as though we're after women's rights. We're not after women's rights at all. Yes, there's an overlap of rights. They've been there for decades.
Mm.
And now we're starting to see, like we saw the other week in the House of Lords, you know, oh, well, that trans women mustn't go into the female estate. Well, okay, some of them might not have to, and the system that they've got at this moment in time actually works.
Prior to FGen starting, Steph's place and your kind of co-hosts, co-writers, were doing a very similar kind of project, weren't you? You were trying to set up something very similar to what is now.
We were going to come up with a second group. The moment that FGen launched, we dropped that because it was very clear what the potential of FGen is going to be, which is massive.
Yeah,
I can see FGen being equal to Stonewall in years to come in regards to its place in society. I hope the gender war will be finished by then. I would love it if it were, so we could get on with proper feminism. Certainly, there's obviously, if you look back historically, you can say there was a gender war going on in the States in the 70s with Janice Raymond. And, you know, the book that she was coming out with, the statements, you can go back to Music Festival. You can go back to Stonewall to some extent, the Stonewall riots, because, you know, there were trans women in that as well, shouting for gay power. So that there has obviously been a gender war there for many years. But the gender war in the UK really only kicked off when Theresa May said to be kinder to trans people. That's really the deciding moment, because at that point, the gender critical movement decided that they were going to conflate the GRA with the EA. And this is something that I've been trying to do along with.
Just so everyone knows, you're talking about the Gender Recognition Acts and the Equality Act.
Yes, exactly. The Gender Recognition Act basically only does one thing. It allows us to change our birth certificate. No more than that. Yes, we can go and get married and, you know, die in our right names, etc. But it's no more than that. It doesn't give us access to single sex spaces. And in fairness, we all do need single sex spaces or safe spaces sometimes. You know, LGBT people often wanted to have safe spaces and safe bars and pubs and things like that. We can't argue that there isn't a need sometimes for single sex spaces. What you can argue is you can't have blanket exclusion. What they've done is very successfully conflated the GRA with the EA. And there's nothing wrong with self-identification. You know, there's countries all across the world that keeps on bringing self-ID out as regards to legal gender recognition by self-ID. You know, more recently, New Zealand, Germany's bringing it in. Ireland's obviously had it for years. It's been available in Argentina for years.
And it's worth mentioning for any listeners that aren't aware, in the United Kingdom, currently passports and driver's licenses are changed. You change your gender on both of those via, guess what, self-ID. And this has been happening. I actually don't know exactly how that has been.
It's not quite right, Violet. You've got to send in a letter from the doctor as well, just to back it. But that's it. You know, it's
I don't even think I need to do that. I need to show them my deeds poll. Maybe I need to show them that I had medication. Yeah, I had a diagnosis. Maybe you're right. But it did not require anything like what. I think the thing with as well, one of the things that's, I think, confusing for people when self-ID comes up is people think, well, surely we must be able to have some sort of qualification of someone changing gender. This hypothetical person might say, I support trans people. I think that people should be able to, you know, live their truth, be who they truly are. And it's like, that's lovely. But they think that there should be some sort of qualification. The issue as a person myself that's gone through the processes, like, and I will be applying for my GRC soon, actually probably within a month, I'll start sending off the documentation. But, you know, the process so far, there is no real, nobody along the way has been able to do anything other than listen to me. And so actually fundamentally, this is on a basis of self-ID. Regardless, what the difference is that I went and I self-identified to medical professionals. And then medical professionals went, okay. And then they asked me, do you understand what you're doing? Do you have realistic goals? Are you otherwise mentally stable? So they were making sure I was healthy, but to determine if I was a woman or not was on my identification. That was the only verification that those medical professionals had. And to remind ourselves, these people are professionals because they know how to look after people's mental health. They're not professionals in what it means to be a man or a woman. I would argue that nobody is realistically an expert in that. So it would be quite foolish to suggest that anyone could be able to accurately verify this. And everything else along the process is literally just to verify how you're living your life. And on a feminist basis, I think it's quite valid to be skeptical of whether, you know, the verification of me living as a woman, because after all, what does that mean? You know, yes, I changed my name. Yes, I, you know, changed my pronouns and my title and everything like this, you know, sure. And of course I started taking hormones and I changed my clothes and I did all these things, but like, that's how I chose to live my life. That's not what makes me a woman, is it? And so this safety that seems to mysteriously arrive from some mysterious verification process, actually, I think, in my opinion, when you look into that, it doesn't really make sense anyway. All it's realistically doing is causing a bureaucratic system to just catalog and make trans people's lives difficult and make us scrutinized by other people for, I would argue, perhaps incorrectly, but I would argue for almost very, very little benefits. I think for healthcare, you know, we should be given help. And I don't have any issue with that, but I don't think that has anything to do with whether shouldn't have anything to do with whether I'm legally a woman or not. And also, it's quite strange. I think we wanted to talk about surgery later, so this might be somewhat of a good segue, but, you know, there's quite a strange thing. You know, when I got the medical letters to change my GRC, so I get that from my doctor has to write a sentence that's sort of explaining what the situation with my genitals are. And I think, as a liberal-minded person, that any system that is requiring the government to have documentation asking about the nature of your genitals and what you plan to do with them, I think we might have made somewhat of a bad step there. That's not a very good precedent for the type of society I want to live in, I would say.
The second part of today's podcast, we were going to talk about trans healthcare.
Yeah.
But just to go back to FGen for a moment, Steph, how do you see Steph's place working in conjunction with and collaborating with FGen as we go forward? Are you going to be continuing to do your articles and kind of the investigations that you do? And, you know, how is that different to you being a member of the FGen steering group? Could you just talk about that a little bit?
The Steph's Place is about a magazine. It's about being perhaps more general market than FGen, albeit I think FGen will, you know, merge into it. There was an overlap. We're huge trans allies, we're huge allies, and I love working with FGen because it's very, very professional. I can see it being a massive group coming forth, as I've said. And I don't think too much had changed, to tell you the truth, from the current arrangement that we've got. Steph's Place website will eventually change. We have got real issues as regards we can't put video on, we can't put many images on because of the format that I went with. When I launched Steph's Place, I never thought that we would be getting thousands and thousands of views.
Yeah, I mean, it's really grown over the past year.
It's massively grown. I look at the stats kind of every couple of weeks, and I just don't know where the people come from. We're getting certainly a lot more hits now from America. Various pages, I mean, obviously the homepage tends to get hit the most. Still get a lot of people look at Karen White's story. Still get a lot of people look at my story, and then I get lots of emails saying, gosh, your story is very similar to my story. Well, yeah, that's because we've all got the same story.
I know. We're repetitive.
And I kind of get emails and photographs pushed through, and we get lots of lovely compliments. For me personally, I want to become more of a feminist. I'm very involved with the Labour Party, as I've mentioned before. Plug. I'm actually the women's officer at Portsmouth CLP. I represent women, and not particularly trans women, because we're all kind of the same boat. We've all got the same enemies. And Steph's Place will just keep on, it appears just to keep growing. I'm very privileged, as I say, of having, we are very privileged that we've got these amazing guest writers that keeps coming in. We want to do more things all the time. And then we will compliment FGen going through. FGen is in a different league to us in regards to potential. We are very much about a magazine, as I mentioned. We'll carry on. FGen, I can't imagine ever doing investigative stuff. FGen is very much more about represented academia, which was well needed. You know, we've got a number of gender criticals there from academia, you know, the Joe Phoenixes of this world, the Kathleen Stocks of this world, who incidentally tweeted that I was a male the other day. Thank you, Kathleen, if you're listening. I have got a picture on the website, the tweet, which she deleted very quickly, but I still managed to capture it. And we've got to fight these people, you know, and these people are representing, sometimes I don't think they realise who the driver of this war is, which is America, Christian extremism. We know about Hands Across the Aisle. We know what the idea is of splitting the T from the LGB, then going after LGB, and then going after abortion rights in the UK. This is what's been happening in America, especially in Texas. When you look back sort of 15, 20 years ago, Texan women had the same abortion or very similar abortion rights to those in the UK. They've all but disappeared now, thanks to Christian right-wing extremists, who are very dangerous people. And they think they're right, and I'm afraid they're wrong. You know, Handmaid's Tale is real. That's the truth of it.
It's interesting with trans rights as well, because there's been quite a lot of investigative journalism in the American rights, looking at after gay marriage went through for lots of states in America. They sort of saw that, the American conservative right saw that as a huge loss, and was a battle that they had been fighting for decades and lost. And they're trying now to use trans rights as this wedge issue to sort of basically considering us the weakest elements, as it were, of the most vulnerable elements of the LGBT community, to try to fight another battle because they lost gay marriage. So just to add to what you're saying, Steph.
One last question I have, you know, on the FGen kind of collaboration topic. FGen, when it was set up, it seems to be very heavily based on academia. There's lots of professors in there.
Yes.
I know you've said in the past that you don't consider yourself to be an academic.
No.
I'm certainly not. I come from, you know, I have a big kind of experience in industry and aerospace field. I'm just wondering, you know, going forward, how is FGen going to kind of accommodate those other areas rather than just academia?
I remember that I was talking with Sally, I think it was in a group, and I just turned around and said, well, I can write a bit, and she just laughed. And I think that was kind of why I'm associated, because I can write a bit.
Your focus is really going to be around comms and media, is that
right? Yeah, around that sort of thing, and knowledge. I'd like to think I've got a wide knowledge of trans things and feminists in general. that's kind of my strength. So I'm kind of a jack of all trades and master of none, perhaps you could argue.
And with it being called Feminist Gender Equality Network, I'm also wondering, how do we include into that title? I mean, it sounds like we've not included trans men in any way. I'm hoping that is totally wrong.
You can
think, man. I think Violet.
No, it's totally wrong. Men can be feminists. I was before I was, a transition. I was still a feminist. Feminist just means equality. If you put it down to one word. Feminist means equality between the sexes.
Also, I think it's important to say that, like, depending on where a trans masculine person might be in their transition, many feminist issues are still going to affect their lives. Like, violence against women and girls specifically, like, for example, of course, pre-transition, that can affect trans masculine people. That's not an invalidation of anyone's identity. I mean, you know, TERFs will weaponize this sort of thing, going, oh, you can identify well that. Well, of course you actually can't. It's going to be on perception. And so the issues of violence against women and girls is on perception, as we all know. So It, of course, this is an area that affects everyone. And I don't know as many trans men as I probably should, and I think I need to get better in the community, but the ones that I do know, most consider themselves actively feminists for some of those reasons, also because they realize how important it is for all of our rights.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make sure that, you know, under that title of FGEN, you know, that we are including all gender identities.
Yes, we are. But, you know, at the end of the day, I was talking to a trans man literally only last week, and he's totally in stealth. The advantage with obviously trans men is that you get remarkably good looking men whom at the same time develop masculine voices because of testosterone. They are just the best. Trans men are amazing. And I was talking to him, so he actually works in a factory, and he struggles a bit with weights, because
don't we all?
Yeah, we do. Tell me about it. I can barely do 25 kilos. It's really pathetic. And so I said to him, okay, so, you know, you've been transitioned now for some time. You're in stealth. Sadly, had to come out not so long ago to the wages department, which is really upsetting, you know, within HE. And I said, well, what's the significant difference? You know, you look like a guy, you sound like a guy, you're being accepted as a guy. And he came out with something really, really that was quite sweet. He said, the difference is with women and men is women can say sorry and men can't. And I thought, God, I've been saying sorry all my life. But it just came down to small things. And but I think in regards to FGEN overall, the feminism isn't about sex or gender, really. It's just about equality. And we fight for women because women are left behind because of the patriarchy and oppression. So it's a matter of balancing things up.
Yeah.
So many different areas. I think it's as simple as that. I hope I've
answered. I think when we talk to Sally and Natasha in one of our next podcasts, you know, we'll probably touch on this topic a bit more. And, you know, around the name, establishing the name and how the difficulties they went through in finalising that.
Yeah.
I think it's important. So, you know, just to kind of state how we got to where we are today.
It was a discussion. We look at, you know, it's very democratic within the group.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm delighted to be part of it. It's, you know, to be in the start with FGEN, it'll be around long after I've gone. This is going to be a massive group, and it's obviously going to upset gender criticals. And my only advice to gender criticals is to stop being an ass. Because ultimately, nothing's really going to change. You're not going to stop me going in a ladies' loo. It don't matter if you come out with a law, I am still going in a ladies' loo.
There's nothing we can do. Like, if they made it illegal for us to live our lives, well, we still have to live our goddamn lives. Like, what are we going to do? Like, where am I going to go? Like,
you're not going to stop living your life, are you?
No, you're not.
Yeah, I'm not going to bloody detransition. You can't make me. So, like... Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I look at Violet. I see a most beautiful young woman, period. You know, she blushes in my screen. But I do. And I'm sorry, they're not going to be able to do a genital check going in the toilet, for God's sake. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've got there is a human right to be able to legally change sex that has been there since 2004. And it isn't going to stop.
And for the record as well, if anyone think, I guess this is a contextualization, because we've talked a lot about the recent gender war, as Steph has been mentioning, but that 2004 rights that was brought in, you know, was after years and years and years and years of work to try and get it through, and only after going to the European courts, because this bloody country has been transphobic for a very long time. Like, we have been, as a country, dragging our feet on trans rights for decades. Like, this isn't a new thing, and this isn't, I find it might be useful for listeners to have this context, that gender criticals will often lie and say trans people have been only asking for rights in the last 5 years or whatever, and it's all so fast and unreasonable, and now all of a sudden we want to use the toilets, public toilets, like crazy people. None of this is true, and this has been going on for decades, like, to get to this position. Actually, as Steph rightly mentions, the only reason this kicked off is because Theresa May, proposed the GRA reform as a policy that presumably she thought wouldn't be popular, and it created this huge backlash. But that's sort of a storm in a teacup. The bigger picture here is that we trans people have always been here, and relatively in different points of history, you know, cis people have done a better job of suppressing us, and maybe they're doing a worse job of it now. But the point is that the actual population isn't created by anything that's happened recently. All that's happening is the social and political environments is changing. And there's a number of people like we covered that just do not like that change.
Yeah. So, I mean, we probably all, the three of us, you know, we're all trans women, and we probably all have slightly different stories as to how we got to where we are today. I mean, if I just explain where I'm up to with the medical side of things, I was very lucky to get included into one of the pilot schemes. I'm in with the Indigo one in Manchester. And initially I was with Sheffield GIC, and I got absolutely nowhere with that. I was on the waiting list for 2 years after going to see my GP initially. I was lucky enough to get transferred onto the Indigo one. And the reason being is because, you know, I've not had a first appointment. These are the criteria for moving over. My GP is within the Greater Manchester area, and I'm over 80. So, you know, those are the criteria. I think all these new pilot schemes, I believe there's four or five of them now, they all took on 500 clients, patients each. And I think the primary reason for that was to reduce the queues at the normal GICs. Now, I don't really want to get into the politics of what Liz Truss kind of claimed this as something that the Conservative Party did. I don't believe it was. I think it's something that NHS England themselves did. But you know, I've used my GP, and I didn't get to the official GICs, but I did get into the Indigo one. And once in that, I got through, you know, all four assessments very quickly. And I'm now at the point where I'm awaiting surgery. I've had my initial assessment and I need to lose some weight before surgery for safety reasons. And I'm fine with that. It's all, you know, it's all going to be funded. That's fine. I think your situation, Violet, is a little different. Maybe you just explain what your situation is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So yes, so I wasn't quite as lucky to get onto one of the pilot schemes in London, which is where I live. There is a pilot scheme, Trans Plus, which is wonderful. And I actually do have multiple friends that were lucky enough to get onto that scheme. And they've had a similar experience where the process has been so much faster than the other systems, and the staff have been very, very kind. And, you know, a significant issue with the other GICs, gender identity clinic is what we're talking to when we say GIC, which is where trans people in the NHS go through to get trans healthcare in the sort of traditional model. And yeah, in these pilot schemes that have been introduced as an alternative routes, they've been much better with a key issue that the GICs have always had, which is being awful with misgendering, for example, which in my opinion is absolutely it's outrageous. I had this experience. So my story is that I registered with the Tavistock Clinic in London, because that's where I'm at, and that's the only option I've had. I did that back in 2019. So it's been coming up to 2 years on the waiting list now. Oh, is that right? Or was that 3 years? Time is getting away from me. And I have no idea when that waiting list all ends. But I had this interesting experience where I was at a certain point in my transition, and the only organization that I interacted with anywhere that was misgendering me and dead naming me was the GIC. They wrote letters to my old name, because they were the only people that were incompetent enough to not have picked up the message or moved forward at all. And this is because they're completely inappropriate for the system. The waiting list is outrageous, and I have absolutely no idea if they'll ever see me. So
have you not had any appointments with them yet?
I haven't had a single appointment with them at all. No, I've never talked to anyone there. And interestingly, with the standard GICs, you know, I've got friends that have gone through and they've had appointments. And what happens is you go to the clinic and you have an appointment, and all you do is give them your information, like your, I don't know exactly what they ask you, but you fill out a form, and then they're like, okay, we'll see you in 6 months. And then they'll do the initial appointments to actually talk to you about your gender in 6 months later, after you've already almost certainly waited multiple years. So anyway, so this is the situation there. So my choice to transition, as you could probably tell, I have actually been transitioning, and was to go with private healthcare. So, you know, I used my savings to pay for hormones, so to get the diagnosis with a private psychiatrist, and then go through a private gender clinic. And that started me off on hormones. And I was lucky enough to be able to get an NHS prescription. So that means I don't have to buy the hormones myself, which would have been a lot more expensive.
So your GP has been supportive in that respect?
Well, actually, not really. I did have to change GP.
You've changed GPs and found one that is.
I've managed to find a GP. Yeah. Wonderful. But yes, that's a normal thing for trans people as well.
Yeah.
If the system realizes that, unfortunately, as Steph kind of alluded to, the training for GPs is not really there. And that's one of the primary reasons that they, that general practitioners aren't dealing with these day-to-day trans healthcare issues, because they're just not trained to do it. And this is an unacceptable position, really. It should be, my opinion is, it should be dealt with very similarly to contraceptives, for example, where the general practitioner can prescribe these hormonal treatments and monitor the patients, but it doesn't have to be this specialist thing. So anyway, so I went through the private routes for that, and also having to pay privately for fertility preservation as well, because there wasn't any provision available until I'd gone to a GIC, and then even then I'm not sure if they would have done it. So I did all of this at personal expense, and yeah, I'm going to have to go private for my bottom surgery, is what trans people tend to call genital surgery.
Just for the, you know, the information for anybody listening, the cost for this surgery is anywhere between, you know, £10,000 to £30,000, depending on where you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really makes me wonder, how do people afford to fund it themselves?
Mm.
You know, I'm not in a position to be able to fund those kind of figures. You know, I'm lucky I've got to where I have via Indigo and NHS. So how are you going to fund yours? Have you kind of thought about what you're going to do?
So I can't afford that at all either. And actually, I'm in the unfortunate situation where, as I said, I funded the rest, which has already cost me several thousand pounds. I was able to afford because I had savings. Unfortunately, I was hoping they would go to other things, but they went to that. But I'm in the situation now that I was made redundant as part of the pandemic as well. And so that's limited my financial options even more. I'm currently crowdfunding to support my surgery. I did lots and lots of research. This is the thing that trans people end up doing, is that because the healthcare support is not very good, often we have to be our own sort of advocates and work out how to look after ourselves. So I've managed to find a surgery option that's on the lower ends of the costs, which is amazing, but also is a world-class clinic, which is the Supon Clinic in Thailand.
You're having to travel overseas to do this.
Yeah, I am. And this is actually, I mean, I think that the provision of surgery is actually hugely insufficient in this country in the first place. One of the issues they have is the bottleneck of how many surgeons we have in the UK. And one of the reasons I'm going to Thailand in the first place is because there they have specialist surgeons that have developed techniques that we just have not invested into in this country. And again, I think that's a systematic issue, where an institutional issue, where the NHS is simply not investing in this in the way that I think would be appropriate. So my surgery is going to end up costing about £13,000 all told. I've already paid a 20% deposit on that. I'm crowdfunding for the remaining 80% of the surgery fee.
So feel free to, tell us which site it's on. If anybody wants to contribute, I'm sure they would.
Yeah, if anyone does want to, it would be really amazing. I've put my crowdfunder on my Twitter. So if anyone wants to find me, you can search my name, Violet Lunston, and Twitter, I'll probably come up. My username on Twitter, if you want to find me directly there, is V_Lunston, and that's spelled LUNDSTEN. So it's a strange spelling, but you can find me there. On my Twitter accounts, I've pinned the link to my GoFundMe campaign there. If you can afford anything, it's life changing.
Absolutely.
There's nothing else to describe it, really. And if you don't have the money as well, but you would love to help me, you'd be willing to help me, any likes and retweets, if you can do that, would be absolutely amazing. So maybe other people that you know might be able to support as well.
Yeah, I mean, I will definitely reshare those. Your Twitter info, as wide as I can. I think it's important to also say that, I know a lot of trans people who are doing this crowdfunding, they're trying to do it themselves, but they always kind of feel really kind of embarrassed to do it. And, it's a very difficult decision to put yourself out there in that position where you're basically, asking other people to help. I don't think, people should feel bad about that, due to the high cost of it. And if there are people out there who are, in a fortunate position who can afford to contribute, please do whenever you see these kind of pleas for help. I think it's very important.
Yeah, I mean, this is a humanitarian issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, this is about people's lives. We know that around third of trans people commit suicide. Sadly, we know the rate in France is 7 times higher than a cis population. We know in America it's up to 10. We know the gender criticals here like to turn around and say, no, that's not right. But I'm sorry, I know trans people that's committed suicide, and I've got lots of friends who also know got friends that's committed suicide.
And I guess as well to say, sorry to interrupt stuff, but just to say as well, I think it's horrible when people would use this to say, well, not that many people have committed suicide. And it's an incredibly callous thing to say. I know in my friend's base, like my friend's circle, I should say, within the trans population, you know, suicidal ideation and dealing with these feelings and having to deal with that as your day-to-day life, you know, feeling the dysphoria, you know, and struggling with that, that's a real like life experience. That there is something we can do about that, you know, like just to say, oh, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't actually kill yourself, well, you're not suffering. And when what sort of rhetoric is this?
Yeah, it's just wrong. And all this could be changed just by GPs. I mean, I think in Wales, they've got this different system to in England, where they've got these specialist GPs that's been trained up relatively quickly. In England, we just haven't done that, very sadly. And the amount of risk that GPs actually have by issuing out hormones, even if they're untrained, is actually relatively low. Ultimately, what you're checking is kidney function, liver function, for a trans woman, possibly PSA, and bone density. But there's not an awful, this is not rocket science. You know, women go to the GP and they get HRT just by turning around and saying, well, I need estrogen.
Yeah.
It's not the same for trans women.
And so I think what we really need is for trans healthcare to be set in the primary healthcare setting, i.e. your GP. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what Indigo are trying to do, or it's part of their remit. But you know, it needs to be much more widespread. It shouldn't be just in four or five pilot schemes. You know, it needs to be across the whole UK.
I mean, you look at the waiting list currently in the Laurels down in Exeter. You're now looking at over five years.
Yeah, I mean that plays into what we were discussing earlier around, you know, whether you wait for NHS to get you through the whole system, and it could be several years, you know, 7 or 8 years before you got to the stage of surgery on the NHS.
I think that's an underestimation.
Yeah, it probably is. And you compare that to, you know, you can have surgery if you pay for it privately, you know, many, many years before then. Yeah, so there's a huge discrepancy there.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got to bear in mind that more and more trans people are coming out because it's socially accepted to be trans. Mm. Society generally accept trans people without problem. The media might not, the gender crits are, and the gender crit allies in Parliament might not, but society are okay with trans people, just as they are with gay people, just as they are with black people, with tall people and ginger people. You know, society understands that we're in a very diverse world. Really, it's very sad that we find ourselves in this position that we've got to fight for healthcare. I mean, I personally had to go private all the way through, and even private, you know, it took me the best part of 10 years to get all the way through.
And have you also used the GIC system or tried to?
No, I transitioned privately. In actual fact, the most expensive part for me was electrolysis, because I had over 300 hours of electrolysis.
Yeah,
and we're talking 75 to 85.
I was paying £50 an hour,
right?
And then I had laser treatment on top of that. It was just my hair color was just wrong. It wouldn't accept to a laser, but equally you can cover it with makeup. So I was years and years in electrolysis, sometimes doing double shifts, and when you're having that needle stuck in your lip, it hurts big time. So electrolysis, and my electrolysis lady, you know, technician, she was amazing. She mainly looked after trans people. She was incredible. And she was £50 an hour, and that's actually cheap.
Yeah.
It is. It is cheap. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think my total transitions are over 30,000. I had surgery in the UK on the 2nd of July, 2019. It was definitely the best day of my life. No question. And did I care a bit, of blood on the floor? No, not at all. You know, so it was a bit of a shock when you go to the Louvre for the first time and you see, you know, a bit of a mess. But hey, it's totally life changing. I think even just having hormones is a huge step. And that's so easily done by a GP if they took the time. And I know they're overstretched. I know it's, you know, they need to get potentially a couple of days training, I understand, from the Welsh model. But they can do so much. There's going to be more and more trans people. We can't have queues that's potentially officially 5 years. It probably in reality is 10 or 15 years.
I think that, you know, the GICs, the traditional GICs, are completely kind of out of date now.
Yeah, absolutely.
That model does not work.
No, it don't.
And I think it's important here to contextualize. There's a very good reason that the GICs, the older GICs are inappropriate, is because they were explicitly originally, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when they were sort of starting to establish, intended to slow trans people down. I mean, they wanted, at first, they wanted to stop as many people transitioning as possible, and they only wanted to let people transition if they thought that they would pass, they would blend into society very well. And so it was explicitly started as a filtration process to try to put blockades in the way of trans people. Now, things changed over the decades, and I'm not saying that the current GICs run in such a manner, but their structure of their appointments and how far apart they set their appointments is set to slow trans people down. This initial appointment where I was mentioning that you just go in to fill out a form and then you come back 6 months later to actually have a real first appointment, that's simply to slow people down. There's no rational reason to do the administration of the GICs in such a way other than under the sort of excuse or the reasoning, one might say more charitably, of just slowing people down, giving them thinking time, for example. Now, this is...
Yeah, that also kind of plays into this real life rule that they're trying to apply.
Yeah, which again is just to slow you down. It's to say, okay, well, you know, if you do this, then after this amount of time, we might give you hormones. And then if you've been on hormones for this long, it's almost like you're getting healthcare for good behavior, which again is...
Yeah,
it's not an appropriate system. And the difference with the pilot scheme like Indigo that you've mentioned is that they're just simply not doing this. What they are doing is informing trans people as to what their options are, what the risks and the realities of these treatments are, such as hormone treatments, such as hormone blocking treatments, such as surgical treatments. And then they're getting on with the process of actually administering this healthcare. And lo and behold, this system doesn't need to be so slow and it doesn't need to be so complicated. Again, to Steph's points, is that once general practitioners have the training, they can deal with so much of the day-to-day, you know, healthcare that a trans person would need. And because of course, like apart from the fact that we're taking hormones typically, we don't have different needs from cis people typically. So it makes sense because we have this issue. And before I stop talking, I'll just say one final thing about my experience. When I had to change GP, the reason I had to change GP was not because, as someone might imagine, that they were dreadfully transphobic. It was because they were well-meaning, but untrained, ignorant in the specifics of trans healthcare and the specifics of trans people. They were, in my opinion, trying to do their best, but they were very concerned because they didn't feel that they had the support that they needed from the NHS to be able to administer this healthcare and feel that they were safe doing so. And frankly, my view of it was that they were worried that they would be punished if something went wrong. And under this concern, and which I don't mean as a small concern, because of course that could be their career, but they need the support to be able to be secure to do this and realize what they need to do. And because they didn't have that support, they simply refused to help me. And they forced me to go to a GP that would help me, which is just not an appropriate system.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all very sad, but we should, I think plus for trans people and, you know, for all of us that's got gender identity issues, if you want to use that word, is that, okay, we are not going to crack the health issue overnight, but as a group of people, of a community, FGEN's given us a huge amount of hope. And we're kind of trailblazing to some extent. I mean, there's been trailblazers every decade. You know, we can look back to April Ashley, bless her, who obviously recently passed, that was, you know, one of the initial trailblazers, and Christine Burns, and wonderful people like that. But all the time, more and more people are coming, especially young people. When you look at the stats, the amount of trans non-binary that's in their 20s is almost 44% of the total community. There's a lot more people to come out. There's a lot more kids to come out, especially non-binary. And I think that whatever the gender criticals do politically, I'm sorry, there is this tsunami of trans people and non-binary people that they are not going to stop. And this is why they really need to give up this stupid war over self-ID. It's not going to change anything. Everyone's just, you know, their safety's, women's safety, is it going to be exactly the same? We're just going to change birth certificates, and we could get on with proper feminism. That, well, I say proper feminism, I'm doing proper feminism already, but I can then concentrate on looking after women and doing my best for women, that's in prison, that shouldn't be in prison at all. Prison should be there for women. We can concentrate on issues like that. We can start looking at the pay gap. We can get more women into government. We can highlight so much more. And the resources that's being lost in the gender war is utterly pathetic. And when I see some of the tweets that, like, Kathleen Stock's coming out with a bee penis, oh, for goodness sake, Kathleen, this is stupid. From an academic... coming out from a professor, I'm sorry, I just do not agree with it. We should be talking about women. We should be talking about society and everything that's wrong in society. And my God, there's an awful lot of rot that's wrong in this society at the moment, that's been driven by capitalism in particular. And I just wish that people, you know, could just come together, try and understand each other's points of view, which I try and do with gender criticals. Yes, I can understand that they're concerned about sex offenders. I'm concerned about sex offenders. I've been attacked. And when it comes to prisons, then, okay, why don't we have trans people, for example, on the local and complex boards? Because we can tell trans people.
Well, yeah, that's fair.
This is the issue. So we've currently got cis people turning around and looking at a potential sex offender or a potential bona fide a trans woman, and saying which estate he, she should be going into, or they. We're actually seeing still 11 trans women sexually assaulted every 33 days in the male estate. Don't get any.
That's important to mention here as well. Yes. The vast majority of trans women are in the male estate.
Yes, they are. And they're being sexually abused, and no one cares. Well, the gender criticals don't care because they're not cis women. Yeah. And I'm sorry, these are human beings. You know, the human beings like Violet, myself, and Victor Vicky, that's been caught up for whatever, you know, and perhaps they are criminals and perhaps they deserve to be in prison. But they don't deserve to be sexually abused. And if that was being shouted about much more, we would be making sort of progress. And unfortunately, at the moment, those sort of odds stacked against us because of media and everything. And This is something that we can do in FGen, is to be able to shout out about this much more.
So if you just kind of imagine all the energy and money and time that's wasted on the so-called, you know, gender critical wars, gender wars, if that same energy was to be put into positive things, just imagine what we could do. Absolutely,
and Julia Serrano's made this point in Whipping Girl. Finn McKay, I recently read a book that came out from Finn McKay. It's called Female Masculinities and the Gender War. Now, I found a couple of those chapters quite difficult because Finn's a trans lesbian. And forgive me, Finn, if you're listening, I've explained that wrong. Apologise. But what Finn says in the book is that both sides should look at it from the other point of view. And I try to look at it from a gender critical point of view. And one of those things is, I don't want sex offenders in prisons. I don't want to see female sport ruined. I want to see female sport exactly as it is now. But I also want to see trans inclusion. And at this moment in time in the UK, they import problems in regards to sport. It used to be Hannah Mountsey. Then we got Laurel Hubbard. So Hannah Mountsey's from Australia. And then we got Laurel Hubbard from New Zealand. Now they're on Mia Thomas from the States, who's going backwards. And she will constantly go backwards as her testosterone levels get lower and lower. I've noticed myself over 10 years how much weaker and slower you get, and it's quite considerable. We've got Piers Morgan out there constantly going on about women's sport. None of us want women's sport ruined. This is not going to happen, but they're importing problems. And yet if you turn around and say, look how many trans women are getting killed in America, well, they don't want to listen about that one, do they? Oh, well, no trans women's been killed in the UK for donkey's years, well, actually it's a couple of years. But they want to import the issue of trans people in sport. But they've got to import the story because there ain't no elite trans athlete in the UK. So the sport issue is kind of a non-issue in the UK, in reality. That's the truth of it. Prisons, well, they're pretty much sorted. The only thing I would say is that trans women in the male estate, we need to look at that issue of why they're being sexually assaulted. We do need to get trans people on local and complex boards so that we can make decisions where alleged or bona fide trans people can go. And I've done a recent investigation into hospitals because the current or the new attack that's going to come in the next couple of weeks from the House of Lords, from Baroness Nicholson and her cohort, is going to be trans women in hospitals. So just before Christmas, I put out some freedom of information requests to 10 different hospital boards, foundation trusts, to see if there's problems with complaints in hospitals over a year period. So I gave them asked for the stats for a year on how many complaints have you had from male or women that trans women were on the ward. And not one hospital foundation trust that's replied has not had one complaint. And yet we've got the House of Lords going to be debating this very issue in a matter of a few weeks. And the gender crits will come up with an AstroTurf campaign to keep males, in inverted commas, into men's wards and vice versa. They want trans men on the women's wards for a problem that don't exist.
They feel very much like manufactured issues, these, don't they?
Oh, absolutely manufactured. Yes. Totally manufactured.
I think the thing that's strange about this whole thing is that it seems like so much of this rhetorical energy from the sort of anti-trans position is this imagining that you can just wish trans people away, wish non-binary people to not exist anymore. If you only marginalized us enough, then we would go away. And this is the problem. It's like, it isn't even necessary for there to be no issues. It's necessary for us to actually look at what we can do in the actual world, the circumstances that we live to deal with this. You know, if this government does actually enact any of these proposed bans that they're banding about for trans women to be excluded from various things, well, we're going to still exist, and this issue isn't going to go anywhere. I think this is the thing. It's like, so much of this seems to be around linguistics. It's like, a lot of the time people will say they're not, they don't think that non-binary people are real, for example. But the thing is that what's the reality of a label to describe someone? You know, it's a communication device. If the person themselves understands themselves better by labeling themselves inside of the non-binary, umbrella, and that I can understand them better by them expressing that they are neither male nor female, or perhaps they consider themselves some combination of both, you know, whatever their individual experience might be. If that communicates the identity of that person better than just saying that they are a man or a woman or what have you, then that is the truth of the matter. What we're looking at are diverse individuals that we want to be able to understand and respect. Respect them, they respect us. That's the goal of being a human, you know? And this is to the end of actually including everyone.
Yeah, you've come up with a really good point there, Violet, because I was talking to Michael Walker at Navarra back in last August, and he said, if someone says they're trans. If someone says they're gay, and I believe them.
Yeah.
He said, but if a gay person turned around and said, I'm gay, and then suddenly, you know, there's a gay guy and suddenly had a female partner, well, obviously that gay person ain't gay. And the same's with us. If we suddenly turned around tomorrow and said, oh, we're going to be cis, which I'm sure none of it is going to happen, you know, because only around 2% of trans people actually detransition. Even though the gender crits are going to be coming up with this, oh, we're going to parade people and say they've detransitioned, it's very few. You're looking at around 2%. Oh, it's all such a mess.
Yeah.
There's such a big, you know, it's such a big topic. We've discussed a lot of kind of, we've touched on a lot of issues today. We've gone over our allotted hour. So I think we should probably end it there. So thanks so much for coming on today, Steph, and talking to us both. Any final words from you, Violet?
No, I've really enjoyed this conversation though. Thank you so much for coming on, Steph, and thank you for being here as well, Vicky. It's been lovely.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks to our listeners. Stay tuned, as they say. I will sign us off there, and thank you for listening.